Hey, y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. God dang, I'm cranky this morning. Well, I know it's the afternoon, but it feels like the morning still. I've been reading all day about killer cops. Man, they're scary. First, somebody tweeted to me a documentary about cops torturing people to death. You know, with poison gas and restraint chairs and handcuffs and knees to the throat and whatever they like. Then I read about why firing a bad cop is damn near impossible. Did you know that in many states, cops have a whole extra separate Bill of Rights, way better than yours, about how any criminal prosecution of their behavior is to be investigated and carried out? Well, yeah, that's because they're law enforcement. See, they have to be immune from it, like they are our born czars, and we are their tiny little pathetic subjects groveling at their feet for mercy. Because that's the American way. They can kill the youngest member of your family and skate. They can kill whoever they want and never get in trouble. And that goes for all cops. And I'm not trying to tempt them. The thing of it is, they all already know that. Any of them who've never murdered anybody are still just waiting for their first chance where they think they can get away with it. Which means, what? Waiting for a clear shot? I love reading, oh, this cop, he was sentenced to 10 years, which was immediately suspended. And he was then sentenced to probation, and he has to go and clean up trash at the park for shooting some lady in the head. Blowing her brains out all over the sidewalk. Oh, picking up trash. I just don't think you're being fair to these guys who risk their lives for us every day, boy. Oh, the poor cops. They have like the 15th most dangerous job in America, all right? And for one of them to have to be sentenced to clean up trash for murdering some lady, why, oh, all of a sudden the world's toughest heroes become the biggest whimpering crybabies. Oh, it's so unfair that any accountability should ever have to apply to them in any case, no matter who they kill. Oh no, our greatest heroes, they need a whole separate extra law enforcement Bill of Rights that says if they murder anybody, nobody's allowed to question them for 30 days. And nothing that they say that implicates them can ever be used against them. And if somehow some rogue prosecutor actually tries to get a grand jury to indict a cop for murdering someone, the grand jury will still stick up for him anyway. Oh no, these deputy sheriffs, why, they are our highest lords and masters. They created our very lives, and they can take them away when they feel like it. We'll say all of the grand jury members in unison. And then if somehow you could transport in a grand jury of, you know, fair-minded adults from Mars or Mexico or somewhere, and they actually indict the cop and they're actually prosecuted, and somehow through some time warp the jury's, well, that time warp wouldn't really be good enough, some sort of Stargate, you're able to find a jury that will convict, and the judge will just suspend their 10-year sentence. Yeah, 10 years for murdering a regular person. Suspended, go clean up trash, and then come the press conferences of all the police unions crying their little eyes out about the unfairness of a system that would persecute one of our heroes by making them clean up trash. It's so very, very sad that there should ever be the slightest bit of accountability for a cop that murders an American. And it goes on. They don't stop. Then I'm preparing for, I'm trying to get the ACLU lined up for today's show, and I'm reading their thing about all the people doing life in prison for nothing. And then I got distracted because I saw a tweet about this other ACLU project. This is actually sort of a side note from life in prison for nonviolent crimes. I don't want to spoil the big surprise before the interview in case it's coming up. It should be. But man, this case, written up by Andrew Cohen in The Atlantic, is unbelievable. And I'm a little bit hesitant to get into it because I still have a question about how this prosecution was carried out that I think the writing is not clear. Maybe someone in the chat room here, I'll post the link in the chat room, and maybe when I get to the dubious part, you guys can help me translate. I don't quite understand. But check this out, man. This is your government. This is how much the cops, who are your security force, who the reason you love them so much and they're your heroes and everything is because they're here for you, right? To protect you from bad things happening to you. This is how much they care about people. Okay, ready? Half a life in solitary. How Colorado made a young man insane. A young man was sentenced to life in prison without parole after a dubious trial. And then things got worse. Alright. So check this out. July 26, 1992. An elderly woman named Frida Winter was murdered in her home in Greeley, Colorado. The police recovered fingerprints from the scene and later found some of Winter's things in a culvert near her home. But for years, the investigation went nowhere, in large part because it was flawed in nearly every way. Other fingerprints from Winter's home were not recovered. Leads were not adequately pursued. Logical suspects were not properly questioned. At the time of Winter's death, Sam Mendez was 14 years old. 4 years later, the police caught what they considered a break. Fingerprints from Winter's home finally found a match in a police database. Yeah, you know, the conspiracy theory machine spit out some nonsense. Well, the computer says. And the match was Sam Mendez, who had just turned 18. The cops brought him in for intense questioning, but Mendez had a strong alibi. He and his grandfather had painted part of her home, the victim's home, in 1991, a year before her death. There was good reason for his prints to have been on the window that was broken on the night of her death. Mendez had been in trouble with the law before, but never for a violent crime. There were no eyewitnesses. There was no confession. There was no evidence of any kind that Mendez had committed murder, that he had murdered Winter. But there was one other link between them. Among the items recovered from that culvert after Winter's death was a matchbook from a business in Henderson, Nevada. Well, the Mendez family had relatives there. That's it. The cops said this proved that Mendez had been inside Winter's house on the night of her death. He had burglarized her home, and thus, under the dubious extension of Colorado law, he was necessarily guilty of first-degree murder. Huh? So the matchbook must have belonged to the robber, not the victim? Because the cops, what, proved that she'd never been to Henderson or knew anyone who ever had or owned matches? Or what? No. And then, okay, so here's the part where I get a little bit confused, and I'm hoping chat room people can help me understand this a little bit more clear. I think it's possibly the writer's fault here for not being clear, the editor's fault maybe. Well, I'll go ahead and blame the copy editor because I don't like having copy editors. The trial of Sam Mendez was a travesty. Prosecutors could have processed him through the juvenile justice system. He was only 14 at the time of his alleged crime, remember? but chose instead to charge him as an adult under Colorado's felony murder rule. That rule is a legal contrivance created by state lawmakers to broaden the scope of murder laws. Under it, any death occurring during the commission of a felony makes every defendant committing that felony susceptible to a charge of first-degree murder. So here's where I get confused, chat room guys. I hope you're keeping up here. I put the link in there for you. It's also on my Facebook page. You can write in the comments there. It's at facebook.com/Scott Horton Show. And now, so it says here, the trial of Sam Mendez was a travesty. Prosecutors could have Prosecutors did not need to prove at trial that Mendez had murdered Winter, or even that he had intended to. They did not need to solve the crime for the jurors. What they did need to do was obey a Brady, which says you have to turn over everything, and that included a prosecution witness who had changed their story. A foul, sure, but no harm, the court ruled. Sort of a red herring there. But I don't understand. Is he saying, it is unclear, is he saying that they did not charge him with murder? They charged him only with the burglary, and they only had to, that was their proof, was, well, his fingerprint is on the pane of glass, and then, but somehow when the jury convicted him only of the burglary, the automatic murder conviction kicked in somehow too, because then it must have been him? Why does he write here that they did not have to solve the murder? He was not convicted of murder, or he was convicted of murder? And I understand that they have in all kinds of states, they have all kinds of laws that say if you do one thing in combination of another, it's automatically a felony. Like if you rob somebody, that's one thing. But if you rob somebody with a deadly weapon, then that's a higher grade of crime, right? Or if you rob somebody, that's a felony. But if you rob somebody with a gun, it's, first degree. That's what I was just trying to say. Or if you use a gun, it's one thing, but if you shoot the gun at somebody or actually kill somebody in the middle of another crime, robbing them, now it's definitely first degree murder. Even if it wasn't premeditated that you would kill them, it was premeditated that you would rob the place, and so robbery plus murder equals first degree, right? That I understand that, but I don't understand what he says here. I mean, they couldn't possibly have gotten a conviction based on just a fingerprint on a piece of glass for murder. I don't know how they could have even necessarily gotten the burglary charge there, assuming he had the alibi that, well, he had painted that house before. He touched that exact window, of course. And then this isn't even the bad part. I'm not even at the bad part yet, but I want someone in the chat room at least tell me you don't understand it any better than I do. Why it is that he writes here, I couldn't find the guy's contact information in a hurry this morning. I wanted to find the author of this. I'm going to ask the ACLU lady. If I hear back from ACLU, I hope that the person that I hear from can comment on this as well. It seems like the Atlantic writer has actually dropped the ball on the writing here. And it's just not clear. So, I don't know. Somehow, they had just a fingerprint and no other evidence whatsoever. The cops said this proved that he burglarized her house, that they found a fingerprint there, that he had an easy answer for, that he had painted the home. And then, but, so, I think that what they're saying is all they ever had to do was prosecute him under adult felony charges in adult court for a burglary they accuse him of committing when he was a child, but they're saying that burglary also happened with a felony, so that means they can try it in adult court, with the murder, which is another felony, first degree felony, so that means they can try it in adult court, but then they didn't charge him with the murder, only the burglary in the adult court. Huh? The hell? Anyway, so here's what happened. They threw him in the pen. This kid, who is obviously 100% not guilty, 100% innocent of these bogus charges, that these police, and I'm sorry about your emotions, if you're an American, then this is going to hurt your feelings so badly because you watch so much TV, you can't separate your own personality from those of your masters who claim to be your security force. The police and the prosecutors and the judges here all conspired together criminally to kidnap and imprison an innocent man for a crime that he never committed when he was an innocent boy. That's it. They are all the guilty kidnappers and conspirators and first-degree felons here, all of them. Each and every deputy involved in this case, every deputy that did not go and arrest the DA for conspiring to imprison, to kidnap and imprison this innocent man, is guilty too. Every cop in the county. They are guilty of at least accessory to kidnapping and extortion and whatever. How come the law doesn't apply to the state? Well, you see, Scott, in America, all government officials, they're all just citizens, just like you and me. And the law applies to them equally, just like you and me. Because the Age of Kingdoms died 200 years ago. Because America killed it off, actually. And now we have laws and citizenship and justice. Huh? And then, here's what happened. They threw him in the pen. Obviously innocent. Everyone knew it. They didn't care because they're all criminals. And then as soon as he got in there, he was placed in solitary confinement. And here's what the Atlantic writer writes. I like the way he says this. Administrative segregation, they call it. The bureaucrats. The party. For institutional offenses so petty that they almost beggar belief, he made a three-way phone call he wasn't supposed to make. He put his key in a bathroom lock after it was closed for the evening. Even Kafka, even Hugo did not memorialize such diabolical perversions of law and justice. For that, Colorado prison officials in 1998 put Mendez away in lockdown, where he more or less remained for nearly 16 years. And they drove him, in fact, completely and totally out of his mind. He's 10 different kinds of schizophrenic, suffers complete and total delusions about every aspect of his life. They destroyed him. An innocent person that they all knew was innocent. And all the appeals court judges and all the rest of them, they love it. They don't care. They don't care. Who told you that they care about you? They would do this to your boy. Don't you see? They would do this to your boy. Why? Because they feel like it. That's why. Who told you that they loved you? Who told you that these people are your security force? Are you crazy? Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks.
Why does the U.S. support the tortured dictatorship in Egypt? Because that's what Israel wants. Why can't America make peace with Iran? Because that's not what Israel wants. And why do we veto every attempt to shut down illegal settlements on the West Bank? Because it's what Israel wants. Seeing a pattern here? Sick of it yet? It's time to put America first. Support the Council of the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org and push back against the Israel lobby and their sock puppets in Washington, D.C. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. Man, I'll tell you what. Them dang old... them prosecutors, man, they're scary. You know, it's all about accountability. That's all it is. You know, it's not... I get all upset and call every government employee a kidnapper and a murderer and whatever, which is mostly true. They're all at least extortionists, every single one of them, without exception. That's what it means to be paid with tax money. You're a thief. You're a criminal. By definition, that's what it means to work for the state. But, yeah, most of them are good people and everything. That's just, hey... completely acceptable in American society to be the most violent and horrible dictator in the world. You just got to get a job working for the government first. Then you can do home invasions. You can kill people. You can set them on fire. You can kidnap their children and frame them for crimes that everyone in the whole wide world knows they could not possibly be guilty of. And there's no accountability. And that's the thing of it. I mean... it's what the state is in the first place, is supposedly legitimized aggressive violence. But because it's legitimate, you have decent people who, most of whom, you know, you got to figure. It's sort of like in a superhero comics or something. Something bad happens to somebody and then they take an interest in that thing. You know what I mean? You might think I was once a victim of American foreign policy, right? Something like that. Somebody's daughter dies of some terrible disease, and then they decide that they're going into the science of researching how to cure it, or they're going to create a foundation that's going to raise money, right? They take an interest. People become cops a lot of times, or prosecutors, because, hey, one time a prosecutor did the right thing and put a horrible person who did something horrible to them or someone else in prison where they belonged. And they decided, you know what, I'm going to grow up and be a prosecutor. I'm going to DA school, and I'm going to take me some bad guys, and I'm going to lock them away. I'm a good guy by definition, by look at what I do to them. But then it's so easy to see how this works with any human being in the same situation, too. Is they get so sure they're the good guy, and the people that they're up against are the bad guy, that they stop really noticing or caring whether the people that they're up against are really bad and really deserve what they're being dealt or not. It ends up just a job, just like anything else. Just like if you work at Subway, putting pepperonis on a piece of bread, before too long, you really don't care if there's a hair on the pepperoni or not. You just do your damn sandwich and be done and move on. It's the same thing. And if they screw up horribly, there's no accountability. And if their former best friend or somebody they know real well in the police department does something horrible, and they conspire to let that cop get away with it and blame their crime on someone else or whatever it is, and they do that, there's no accountability. There's nothing stopping them. And so, therefore, they all slouch toward horrible. No matter how good they're supposed to be at their job. I told you the story before. This guy, I didn't point my finger at him because I didn't recognize him because I was more looking at the weapon than his face. But I was once a prosecution witness. I ain't no rat. I just walked in on an armed robbery. And I described what happened to the victim as I saw it. I described the getaway car as I saw it. It was up to the rest of the government's case to connect the guy in the car and whatever. But I just testified that whoever it was, hell yeah, he had a club in his hand, and this is what he did to the old man, and it was horrible. But anyway, I told you this before. I met with the assistant DA a couple of days, I think 2 days, before my testimony at the coffee shop. I walked her through exactly what I saw. She took notes. We went through it again. I don't remember exactly, but at least twice, whatever. I elaborated on everything I thought she needed to know, whatever. And then when I got up there to testify, like 2 days later, she didn't have the first freaking idea how to examine me. I'm her witness. And she couldn't even effectively just say, well, tell me what happened then. Or in a general enough way that I could just go ahead and tell her the story. She's trying to ask specific questions, but they're all the stupid wrong questions, stupid. What are you doing? Do you want to know what happened or not? And that was her, you know, prosecuting a guy who I think, you know, was pretty much found out that he was the guilty in that case. But that kind of incompetence is not punished. And in fact, if it was the wrong guy, I may have well convicted the wrong guy. Because look at how incompetent she was. She couldn't even examine me, her witness, who just told her the story 36 hours before or something. How do I know she did? How should any of us trust that she did a good job on any of this stuff? You know? Maybe they didn't get the right guy at all. I mean, they claim they had the limp and the witnesses and his girlfriend turned on him and everything. So I don't know. But anyway, there's no accountability. That young assistant DA lady is still up there prosecuting people, whether they did it or not. Whether she has the first freaking clue about the case that she's prosecuting or not. And I told you before, too, from when I was a cab driver, I'll never forget, and I'll tell it a million times. It's the most important thing I know, probably. Assistant DA from Houston, Texas, Harris County. That is second place for executions behind, maybe third place, behind America in general and China for executions on the face of the planet. And down there, they have a slogan at the assistant DA's office, and the slogan is, if they really didn't do it, they'll get out on appeal. Which means if the cops bring you someone, you nail them to the wall. You try to give them the death penalty if you possibly can. Otherwise, whatever. You give them as harsh as the state of Texas can possibly come down on someone. And then, hey, if it turns out that it really wasn't the right guy, well, then once they're in the penitentiary and the burden of proof is on them to prove that the process was flawed, then they'll probably get out. You see how unfair that is? You could even have proof that you're innocent. But unless you can prove that the judge and the prosecutors did something improper in the way that they tried you, the fact that you can prove you're innocent doesn't necessarily have a thing to do with whether you were fairly convicted or not, buddy. Just because you got some evidence now, you say. Don't worry about it. If they really didn't do it, they'll get out on appeal. When the burden of proof is on them, 2/3. To prove that the trial itself was flawed. That's what's called the rule of law in America. Innocent people rotting in solitary confinement. Like in Saudi Arabia or some hellhole.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation. As you may already be aware, Jacob Hornberger, Sheldon Richmond, and James Bovard are awesome. They're also in every issue of The Future of Freedom, and they're joined by others of the best of the libertarian movement. People like Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, Lawrence Vance, Joe Stromberg, and many more. Even me. Sign up for The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom, edited by Sheldon Richmond at fff.org/subscribe. And tell me you heard it here. Hey, y'all, Scott here, hawking stickers for the back of your truck. They've got some great ones at libertystickers.com. Get your son killed, Jeb Bush 2016, FDR, no longer the worst president in American history, the National Security Agency, blackmailing your congressman since 1952, and USA. Sometimes we back Al-Qaeda, sometimes we don't. And there's over 1,000 other great ones on the wars, police state, elections, the Federal Reserve, and more at libertystickers.com. They'll take care of all your custom printing for your band or your business at thebumpersticker.com. libertystickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today was supposed to be our third guest yesterday, but second or something. But we went over with Leopold about his great story on Abu Zubaydah's journals. So here we got Gareth now. He's writing at truthout.org as well as ipsnews.net. And this one is about the failed talks last weekend. And this one is about the failed Iran talks last weekend. Why Iran nuclear talks failed and why they will get tougher. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thanks, Scott.
I appreciate you joining us on the show, as always. Why did the Iran nuclear talks fail?
Well, I think the simple answer is that there was a change in signals. Thursday night, when the talks were supposed to go into high gear, there was a text that was presented to the Iranians. The Iranians were happy with it, and that was the understanding that was going to be the basis for the final push to get this through, that they had basically a text the United States and Iran were in agreement on. Then, of course, the French came into the picture, and the mystery here is exactly what the sequence of events was. Exactly when did the French get the United States to make changes in the text? We don't know exactly when that happened. But what we do know, or at least I think we know, is that Mohammad Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, has tweeted in the last 24 to 48 hours that there was a text that was gutted, his quote, his term, was gutted sometime between Thursday night and Saturday night. At least 50% of the text, according to Zarif, was gutted, meaning that they changed the wording so that it was really quite different. And clearly, he's referring to the issues of the Arak, A-R-A-K, heavy water reactor, the disposition, as they say, of the 20% enriched uranium stockpile of Iran. I think clearly there was something there having to do with the right to enrich, that pertained to the right to enrich, that was affected by this, what has now been called moving the goalposts, but I think essentially was forcing the United States to make some changes in the text. And I think that raised serious questions in the mind of the foreign minister of Iran and his team as to whether they could continue. Well, obviously they were not ready to sign it, and they said, we have to go home, and we're going to have to regroup here. But I think that's the short version, or as short as we can make it, of what happened.
All right, now, well, I guess I'll go ahead. There's so much here, but let's get to why they'll get tougher then, these talks.
Well, I think they're going to get tougher because, first of all, the Iranians cannot come back to the table without demanding that the text be returned to what it was before the French, acting on behalf of the Israelis or reflecting the Israelis' concerns, quote-unquote, demanded change in text, which the United States obliged them. That's what's important, of course, is not that the French made the demand, but the United States, from all that we understand that has come to light in the last few days, the Americans obliged them by changing the text, and I think the Iranians must demand that the text be returned to where it was before that happened. I don't see how they can do anything otherwise. I mean, for one thing, they are under intense pressure at home from the nationalist right. There's no question that there's a lot of criticism of the negotiating position of Iran. There's the exact opposite of what the right wing in the United States and Israel are saying is being levied against the Iranian negotiators at the table. They think that they've gone too far in accommodating the United States. I think that's just a reflection of the factional politics within Iran, as well as a very powerful cast of nationalism that suspects the worst in these kinds of negotiations with the United States. So I think that's one reason they have to do it. And I think the second reason is that under these circumstances, the Iranians have to take seriously the problem of U.S. overconfidence, that they feel that they have their foot on the necks of the Iranians, or the neck of Iran, if you will, because of the sanctions, because Iran is hurting economically, and that this has contributed to a sense on the part of the Obama administration that they can, in fact, toughen their stance and get away with it. I don't know if that's the case, but I think that is certainly a legitimate fear that must be under discussion right now in Tehran as far as preparing for the next round of talks.
Right. Not that the Americans are really that far ahead, but that they think they are, and how problematic
that is. I think that there might, it might well be the case that the Obama administration made that adjustment on behalf of the Israelis, in effect, in large part because they felt that, well, who knows, maybe we can get away with it. Maybe the Iranians feel under such pressure that that they will have to sign, despite the fact they don't like what we're doing here.
Yeah. And now, when you say that the Iranians will have to insist on the previous version, are you talking about on all three big red herrings here, the Iraq facility, the 20% stock, and the future right to enrich?
Absolutely. I mean, those are all issues on which, they certainly, I mean, we don't know exactly what the language is, of course, that the French were saying they wanted to be changed to, but one can bet, I think, with a great deal of confidence that the language that was agreed to on behalf of the French-Israeli view was something that would have been, certainly unacceptable to Iran, that would have required a very major change in the situation from what the Iranians expected. And look, the point here really is that Iran was prepared to stop 20% enrichment and to assure the United States that that all the existing stockpiles were going to go into this stream that would result in the manufacture of fuel plates, so that it wouldn't be available for a breakout. And that is a very far-reaching assurance. It's giving up part of the negotiating leverage that Iran had accumulated. They were carefully accumulating their negotiating chips for leverage over the last few years, and this 20% enrichment and the stockpile were a significant part of that negotiating leverage that they had acquired. And they're giving that up in return, in large part, I think, not so much for the few billions of dollars that they're going to get from this rather offhand offer, but from the United States that they will have a very, very partial rescinding of the sanctions, but not the most important sanctions. Clearly, the ones that really hurt them the most, they're not going to be affected by this. So what the Iranians are getting in return really is, I think, the recognition of their right to enrich. That's the one thing they can point to, or they thought they could point to, in this preliminary agreement as an end state that the United States had agreed they were working towards. Now that that appears to be gone, I think that the deal certainly becomes clearly a bad deal for Iran. They couldn't afford to agree to anything like that.
That's ridiculous. What about what a bad deal this supposedly is from the right-wingers? Let's try to give them a fair hearing here. The pro-Israeli war party says that, oh, come on, this is, any kind of deal that Kerry's trying to make here is giving away the whole store. It's not just letting them enrich uranium and keep the facilities that they could use to one day make a uranium nuke bomb, but also this Iraq facility. They're kicking the can down the road on the Iraq facility, and if 10 or 15,000 impossible things happen, they could make a plutonium bomb out of that Iraq facility.
Well, I think you quite accurately capture the spirit, if not the letter, of the argument that's being made. And I think that
I'm not being fair to them at all, though. Did I leave anything out? They don't have any other argument than that?
You didn't leave anything out. I think that captures the essence of the argument that's being made. The problem, of course, with that argument is that it is simply not reflective of any of the realities that surround these issues, certainly the issue of Iraq. In the first place, of course, there is no capability in existence for the taking of the spent fuel and reprocessing it by Iran to use for a plutonium bomb. I mean, they have nothing of that sort. There's not a scintilla of evidence of that. To build a plutonium reprocessing facility is a major undertaking. You can't just hide it. You can't do it in a little cave. It doesn't work that way. There's no question that that there's not the least anything like a capability to actually reprocess and have the capability of doing a bomb. And furthermore, I think even more importantly, we know that that Javad Zarif, in his PowerPoint presentation of mid-October of this year, to the United States and other diplomats, was saying that Iran is prepared to have arrangements by which the spent fuel would be immediately taken away and not be available, even if they change their mind and they somehow secretly try to have a reprocessing facility. So, the basic premises of this complaint about Iraq are simply utterly out of, there's no reality to them whatsoever.
Well, now, part of it, though, is they're saying that, okay, listen, worst case nightmare Likudnik scenario, they decide that, aha, actually we are going to harvest plutonium out of that reactor and figure out how to reprocess it, build the facility to do it, even if they got to withdraw from the treaty in order to go ahead, because there's no way in hell they could do it secretly. They'd have to take the lid off the damn thing in front of all the satellites and everything to harvest the plutonium out of it, let it cool for half a year or something.
Point,
and all
point
this
number
to turn
three.
It off.
But
it'd be too late
three,
to bomb
however.
Them, Gareth. We wouldn't be able to carpet bomb the Iraq facility at that point once
there
they had
okay.
declared that intention, because we'd spread dirty bomb stuff everywhere. So we got to stop them before they get to the point where we can't bomb them.
Yeah, hold on. That idea of bombing the Iraq facility is completely and utterly bogus. I mean, there is no there's absolutely no reasonable scenario under which Israel is going to bomb that facility. In the first place, within 6 months of this preliminary agreement, there's going to be, there's supposed to be a final agreement. And if the United States signs on to what I think the Iranians are demanding in the preliminary agreement, that agreement will certainly indicate that the Iraq facility will be covered in full. There will be no way in which the Iraq facility will be used for a plutonium reprocessing and used for a bomb. All of those things will be provided for, will be anticipated in the final agreement, and the United States still, of course, holds all of the, not all the negotiating cards, but they hold significant leverage in the form of these very biting, crippling, sanctions against Iran. So, the United States still has the ability to say to Iran, I mean, you have to do what you promised, in this initial agreement, or we will continue to hold on to the leverage that we already have. And that is, that is the kind of negotiating dynamic that can create, in the end, an agreement that will serve the interests of both sides. Now, what of course the Israelis want to do is to prevent that agreement, not because it's going to allow Iran to have the capability to make a bomb, but because it's going to allow Iran to recover from the sanctions. That's the reality. That's what Israel wants. They're going to continue to threaten to bomb, not because they intend to do so, as I've said many times on your show, but because this is part of the ruse that's aimed at keeping the United States and the Europeans, the Russians, and the Chinese from going ahead with an agreement that would be in everyone's interest.
Yeah. You know what I don't get? How come the Americans couldn't push back against the French and say, oh, no, you don't, man. Hey, listen here. You want to not be friends anymore? We'll hold a grudge against you for this.
I think that's a very good question, and I think the answer is that this... I think there's a twofold answer. One part of it is that the United States is still not ready to openly dissent from what the Israelis are trying to do to this negotiating process. They don't want to tell the truth because it, you know, heightens the contradictions between the United States and Israel. They're simply not ready to do that. And the second part of it, as I suggested earlier, I think the Obama administration may be leaning more than a little bit in the direction of overconfidence with regard to their what they perceive to be their negotiating leverage with the Iranians, the bargaining strengths of the two sides, if you will.
So the American reaction to the French was, hey, yeah, you're right. We should stick it to them a little harder, huh?
Well, I don't think that they would have quite been that, sort of lacking in diplomatic...
Well, we're talking about John Kerry.
Yeah, right. Well, but I think the reality is, though, that when confronted with a choice between saying, no, you can't do that, and the fact that you're doing it is an act of bad faith, which we resent, and is illegitimate, and we must put a stop to it, they decided to swallow what was going on, and that does reflect a political orientation, which is a very serious problem, and I think that part of it is indeed that that they felt they could get away with it. If they didn't feel they could get away with it, they wouldn't have done it. So I think that is a problem of U.S. perception of its relative power in the situation. And let's face it, I mean, this is the end result of decades of U.S. dominance of the world system, U.S. military dominance, U.S. economic dominance. It all adds up to a sense on the part of the U.S. national security elite that they can, in fact, carry out coercive diplomacy. That's been a term that has been immensely popular and credible within the U.S. national security elite for so many years that even people like Tom Pickering, who are really, pretty reasonable on the issue of negotiating an agreement with Iran, were not prepared to say, look, the United States has to take this threat to use military force off the table. It is not only stupid, it's counterproductive, it's not going to do us any good, it can only do us harm, because of the idea that has become so deeply ingrained on the part of the national security elite that we have this advantage, and therefore we gotta keep using it.
Right. Well, yeah, especially, the headline this morning in Reuters, I'm sure you saw, is that the new IAEA report, which you've probably seen that.
I have not seen the new IAEA report. Actually,
well, it's coming out, and Reuters is saying that they virtually halted any expansion of the program since Rouhani has taken power. They seem to really be trying over there. There was a story a couple of weeks ago where the Ayatollah made some statement like, hey, people criticizing the president and his administrators for trying to do this deal ought to pipe down. I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like that, and that, I'm sure, carried a lot of weight over there. That was a big deal that he was coming out that strongly in favor of the negotiations. And here's the thing, and obviously, as you're saying, this is the big hang-up, is whether they have the right to enrich or not. But as you and I've been talking about for 5 years on the show, since Obama came into power, his very first indications of the swap deal that he ever wanted to do was an implicit, if not explicit, recognition of Iran's right to go ahead and keep enriching. Just don't go up to 20, keep it at 3.6% or whatever, and then we'll go on from there.
Sure,
and
so they've understood, I think, that realistically they couldn't prevent Iran from having some low level,
so 3.5% why not just say
enrichment.
So I mean, Gareth, everyone on earth knows that every non-nuclear weapon state with a nuclear program has something akin to a breakout capability, one degree or another, and that's not illegal.
It's
so
not
why can't
illegal.
They just say that? It's ridiculous. That should
exactly
be the hang-up.
Right. And I mean, I think there's an even more important and more serious issue here that needs to be brought out. And of course, this brings me back to my book, which we'll be talking about over the next few months before it's actually published, I know.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that I explore in this book in great detail is the myth that has become enormously widely believed in political circles in the United States, and basically among people who read newspapers and watch television, that what has happened here is that the Iranians began to fiddle around with, sort of experimenting or doing research that indicated that they wanted nuclear weapons way back in the 1980s, and that ultimately they were caught red-handed, they were found out, and that this is why, they can't be trusted, so on and so forth. Now, the reality, historically, of course, which I'm going to detail in my book, is that the Iranians not only were not, messing around with nuclear weapons in the 1980s or early 1990s, but in the early 1980s, the mid-1980s, they were actually not even anticipating, not expecting to, not demanding or wanting to do any enrichment on their own soil. They were going to depend on the French, to enrich uranium for them to be turned into fuel rods for Bushehr, which was, of course, already in existence when the Islamic Revolution took place in 1979. So the reality is that they were prepared to live with, that is, the Islamic Republic was prepared to live with a situation where Iran wasn't even enriching its own uranium. It was going to depend on people outside, in fact, in Europe, to provide it with fuel rods. And that only changed after the United States began to put pressure on the French and the Germans not to cooperate, even with the very limited, modest, and totally non-proliferation-oriented nuclear program that Iran still had maintained after the revolution. So that absolute inversion, the turning on its head of the history, the early history of the Iranian nuclear program, and the sequence of developments which resulted in where we finally got, which was the Iranians deciding that they had to have their own independent capability to enrich uranium, is really at the heart of this entire problem of the lie surrounding the Iran nuclear scare.
Yeah. Well, we need a good excuse to beat them over the head all day. It's not like any of this has anything to do with the actual issue in question.
Theme that,
right?
I cover in the book is that the CIA and the military, of course, needed an adversary that provided the rationale for them to continue to have to demand the level of appropriations from Congress that they'd gotten during the Cold War, and that was over now. The Soviets were gone; they had nothing to replace it unless they could come up with the myth that there were rising states that were going to pose the same kind of danger in terms of nuclear weapons that the Soviet Union posed in the Cold War period.
Mm. All right, so now when I talked to Flint Leverett, I was explaining to him how I was more disappointed this time because I really thought that, unlike in 09, it seemed like they really meant it, right? I mean, with the foreign minister showing up and everything, And then the French came in, but he also talked about all the reasons that the Americans blew it, not just the French and the Israelis as well. And he kind of argued with the point and said that he thought that this was just like 09, where they're going through the motions, but they don't even mean in the first place to do what it takes to get this thing done. It just seems to me such a schizophrenic thing. I don't know exactly if you agree with that or not, but Obama's saying things like, Congress, if you pass these sanctions, the American people don't want a path to war. I'm trying to solve this here, and you guys are screwing it up. And that's pretty strong language for a president. And then he goes in there, all half-assed and doesn't get the job done. So,
well, and this is, I'm suggesting that, I don't know if I disagree with Flint or not. I'm not sure exactly because I didn't hear exactly what he said. But
yeah, don't count on my interpretation.
Yeah, if you look at it in terms of those two problems of the United States, the Obama administration still fearing to confront as directly and energetically as it needs to confront the Israeli effort to sabotage these talks, and its sense of the temptation to feel overconfident about its bargaining position, I think that explains the bargaining, the negotiating behavior of the United States in Geneva. And whether that means that they never intended to do it just depends on how you define that. I think that they would like to have an agreement. I think they hope that they can get an agreement. I don't think that they are very clear about how they're going to do it. And I think that there's a serious danger that they will fail in the end to do what they need to do in order to secure it. I mean, I still have grave concerns about whether this administration has what it takes to do what's necessary.
Yeah. And now, this is just a minor footnote kind of a point, but you mentioned money transfer as being part of the deal. And, you know, that makes a great talking point for the right if it's just a welfare payment for America. But my understanding was that that was Iranian money that the Americans had so-called frozen. Otherwise, you know, other people call that stealing. But that it would just be releasing that money back to them. That's,
absolutely,
it's actually
yes.
their money. Is that right?
That's precisely so. It is Iranian assets which are held in various countries that are obviously cooperating with the United States
right.
to, you know, maintain this as leverage. And so, you know, it is Iranian assets, and it's part of the U.S.-Iranian conflict going back decades, but it's been updated. And, you know, they're not even talking about very much. We're talking about a few billion dollars. I mean, really, they're not talking about releasing tens of billions, which is what which is what is at stake here. There's, as I understand it, $80 billion held in these countries, which are not available at this point to Iran to be used for anything except buying products from those countries, which the Iranians can't use. So, you know, this is a serious, it's part of the serious problem that are problems being caused by the sanctions to Iran. But what we're offering is not much, not very much.
All right, everybody, that's the great Gareth Porter, this time writing at truthout.org. Thanks, Gareth.
Thank you very much, Scott.
The article is Why Iran Nuclear Talks Failed and Why They Will Get Worse. Tougher. Yeah. How it came up with worse there. How they will get dumber. We'll be right back after this with Andy Worthington.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager whose site is unique on the web. Subscribers are allowed a window into Mike's very real main account and receive announcements and explanations for all his market moves. The Federal Reserve has been inflating the money supply to finance the bank bailouts and terror war overseas. So Mike's betting on commodities, mining stocks, European markets, and other hedges against our depreciating dollar. Play along on paper or with real money, and then be your own judge of Mike's investment strategies. See what happens at WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. Man, I had a chance to have an essay published in the book Why Peace, edited by Mark Gutman, but I didn't understand what an opportunity it was. Boy, do I regret I didn't take it. This compendium of thoughts by the greatest anti-war writers and activists of our generation will be remembered and studied long into the future. You've got to get Why Peace. You've got to read Why Peace. It features articles by Harry Brown, Robert Naiman, Fred Bronfman, Dahlia Wasfey, Richard Cummings, Karen Katowski, Butler Schaefer, Kathy Kelly, Robert Higgs, Anthony Gregory, and so many more. Why Peace? Because war is the health of everything wrong with our society. Get Why Peace. Down at the bookshop or Amazon.com. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Appreciate you tuning in. Next up is our friend Andy Worthington. His website is andyworthington.co.uk. andyworthington.co.uk. He's the author of the book, The Guantanamo Files, the stories of 759 detainees in America's illegal prison. And he's also the director and producer of Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. Welcome back to the show, Andy. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing very good. Appreciate you joining us today.
Well, it's always a pleasure.
Good times. Hey, you don't sound very good. Are you on a headset or something?
No. I'm on the phone. Is it not good?
Yeah, I mean, it's passable, but it's not great. But you're not on any kind of...
I'm afraid to say. This is the landline, so...
All right. Well, it's going to be fine. Everybody can understand you. That's for sure. So we'll continue. So, listen, it's been... it's right around anniversary time, the 12th anniversary of the creation of Guantanamo and the legal regime, really, that created Guantanamo. And you had sent me this link to this old story from 07 that you had written about Dick Cheney and his lawyers and the different men inside the different departments in the White House, the Vice President's office, the Pentagon, and the Department of Justice, and the Office of Legal Counsel, etc. who wrote up this torture regime and the whole rationale behind it. It's such an interesting story, and I thought it'd be great if you could give us a retelling of that before we get back to more current news about Guantanamo, the possibility of closing it, etc.
Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing is, Scott, that it was interesting because I think Colonel Morris Davis, who was the former chief prosecutor of the military commissions at Guantanamo, a man who had a fabulous conversion against believing everything that he'd been told about the war on terror, and you know, for the last 6 years has been an implacable critic of everything to do with Guantanamo. He wrote an article on November the 13th this year, saying that it was 12 years of Guantanamo, which, you know, I think triggered large parts of the media to pick up on it. It's not the 12th anniversary of Guantanamo in the sense that the actual prison opened on January the 11th, 2002, and on November the 13th, 2001, nobody was doing any work on the U.S. naval base in Guantanamo. They were still tossing ideas around as to where they were going to hold people. But the key document responsible for establishing that they were going to create Guantanamo, they were going to create this legal black hole on some location that belonged to America, but that legally they hoped would be beyond the reach of the courts, was this military order that was stealthily passed by, well, essentially, you know, Dick Cheney single-handedly made sure that this thing, you know, started to get the wheels rolling on November the 13th, 2001. And it's a document that at the time, I mean, you know, you've got to go back to 2 months after the 9/11 attacks that most people were not being encouraged to scrutinize very closely what was going on with their government at the time. But I remember reading years afterwards that when I first started really getting involved in Guantanamo, that Michael Ratner, the founder of the Center for Constitutional Rights, had realized when he heard about this document how serious it was. I had a friend who passed away a few years ago called Charlie Gittings, an American friend who started a campaign and a website called the Project to Enforce the Geneva Conventions. The reason that he became obsessed with this issue was because of this military order. And, you know, and I found out about how stealthily it had been introduced by Dick Cheney in an article in the Washington Post back in 2007, which I wrote about, by Barton Gellman and Joe Becker. And it was a series on Dick Cheney. I believe that Gellman later had a book about Cheney. And it was the military order, which he basically got a couple of signatures in the dead of night from people in the White House, and then you know, made sure that it got out there without anybody really being able to question it, was this document that established that they were that the U.S. government was going to create military commissions to try prisoners that were seized in the war on terror, if that's what they wanted to do. And, you know, and it was basically the document that set up the not just the trial possibilities, but the detention possibilities. And the military commissions were there if they wanted to try people. But basically what Cheney was doing was saying, this is how America is now behaving. We are going to round up whoever we want. We're going to hold them for as long as we feel like. If we're going to put them on trial, then what I've done is that I've ransacked the history books and I've come up with the military commissions that have been used at various times in America's history, and these are what we're going to, a version of these is what we're going to use this time around in our war on terror for trying people that we say are terrorists. So, you know, a pretty major document.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny the different excuses that they use, too. And I don't know if this goes back to the original documents that you're talking about, but it seems so thin when they said, well, you know, the Taliban aren't members of the Geneva Conventions. But that doesn't have anything to do with what the Geneva Conventions say at all. The Geneva Conventions say that everybody who is a signatory to it is bound to behave like in the deal. It doesn't require that the people that you're up against are also signatories to the thing, and it never did, and it never had been interpreted that way before, right? I mean, they're just making stuff up.
One thing that obsessed them was how they could create a category of human being that didn't receive any protections. And, you know, and that's fundamentally misunderstanding But although, you know, although there are obviously different parts of the Geneva Conventions apply to different people in different ways, and arguments can be held about exactly, you know, what applies to whom, it was never the truth that the administration wanted, which was that there were people that weren't covered. But, you know, you may remember, I'm sure, Scott, that in January 2002, so when Guantanamo was being set up and paving the way for the memo that President Bush issued on the 7th of February 2002, the official U.S. torture document, when he said, you know, the Geneva Conventions don't cover Al-Qaeda and Taliban, and gave some waffle about how, you know, to the extent possible, the spirit of the Geneva Conventions will be applied. You know, just rubbish. I mean, that didn't cover the fact that what he'd actually done is say, you know, we are free to torture these guys. You know, from that date until June 2006, when the Supreme Court turned around to the Bush administration and said, by the way, you know, the case was about the military commissions, and they threw them out, said they're illegal. Congress then brought them back. But, you know, the Supreme Court also said to the president, you know, we think that you have forgotten that everybody who is in your custody is entitled not to be tortured. The common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions applies to everybody. You know, it took 4.5 years before the highest court in the land turned around to them and said, guys, there isn't a category of people who aren't protected. You are not allowed to torture or abuse anyone in your custody. You know, and that was hugely significant. But it's, you know, it's deeply shocking that for 4 years and 4 months, essentially, the United States was officially torturing people.
Well, and then this is a big deal, too, that the August 2002 memo didn't come until after they figured out that, boy, we better write up a memo to legalize the torture that we've been committing against Abu Zubaydah, the guy that we interviewed Jason Leopold about yesterday, who turns out wasn't really an Al-Qaeda guy at all. He just ran a summer camp. Well, it was a training camp, but it wasn't really an Al-Qaeda training camp there in Afghanistan.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, and it's always been... it's always been one of those things, really, that, you know, they had him on the 28th of March 2002. The U memo authorizing his torture was August the 1st, 2002. You know, we've had Ali Soufan of the FBI saying that sometime in June, you know, he stopped working with the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah because the CIA were starting to torture him. You know, the U memo is the absolute golden shield that if you look up the words Dick Cheney and golden shield, you will find that Dick Cheney permanently invokes that memo as protecting him and the other torturers of the Bush administration from accountability for what they did. Lawyers told them what the lines were that couldn't be crossed. The truth is, Abu Zubaydah was being tortured for months before the phony memo was written that laid down the lines that apparently can't be crossed. You know, that memo is wrong, but it's regarded as legally defensible, you know, but they were torturing the guy anyway.
Yeah. And now we got to talk, too, about, well, there's so many things here. First of all, I think it's so important, and, you know, veteran listeners of this show, if you can call them that, longtime listeners of this show, they're aware of this, but I know that most people aren't because they just never talk about it this way. But that is that it's not a few Al-Qaeda guys were waterboarded here and there. Tens of thousands of Afghans and Iraqis, maybe more, were tortured under these loopholes and under the impression that everybody got up and down the chain of command everywhere that none of our enemies here have any rights to be respected whatsoever. And so all of the things that America prosecutes people for torture for, including, you know, mock executions and tying somebody up and beating the hell out of them or almost drowning them to death or the sleep deprivation and whatever, all of those things became quote-unquote legal, de facto legal, became part of the practice all across Iraq, not just at Abu Ghraib, but remember Tony Lugaranis in the torture question, the PBS documentary talked about, man, we tortured them in their living rooms in front of their kids, we tortured them on the side of the road, we tortured them in the backyard, we tortured them with a box and with a fox and everywhere, and tens of thousands of them without limit.
Right.
So, yeah, somebody got dunked in the water a few times. Somebody who knocked the towers down got dunked in the water a couple of times. Boo-hoos, say the apologists. But that's fine as far as it goes, which it's arguable as far as it goes. But that completely ignores the fact of what happened to innocent men by the and women and children by the tens of thousands across the terror war. And in fact, right now, at least, most recent reporting in Somalia under American supervision as well. Two different dungeons there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, no, absolutely. And, you know, the real bottom line of that is that, you know, the military are people in the military obey orders. So the responsibility is for the people who give them those orders to set the parameters. And the reason that all of this abuse took place everywhere that you're talking about, and it's a very powerful and pretty truthful way of putting it, I think, as well, Scott, is that the people who were responsible for giving them their orders, and that's, you know, that's coming down from the President of the United States and the Vice President of the United States and the Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, abdicated their responsibility to tell these people what they could and couldn't do. You know, and in a lot of cases, what we found out is that people were given leeway, and, you know, in the notorious examples that we know about, people were told, you know, to make things difficult for people, make sure they didn't sleep well. But across the board, what happened was that people whose job it was to be told what to do by their superior officers, to be told what was right and what was wrong, their superior officers failed them. So, you know, you're right, but who is to blame for this? And, you know, and it's Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld.
Absolutely.
And the lawyers who advised
and it's not
them.
Just, it's not any kind of negligence either. I mean, when they took General Miller from Guantanamo and they brought him to Iraq in order to Gitmoize the process, that was their words. Was they wanted to deliberately import that system to Iraq. All the guys at Abu Ghraib on the night shift said, hey, we were softening them up for when the intelligence guys arrived. Did anybody doubt that that was true? That they were told that that's what they were supposed to do? Was get these guys, you know, looking forward to someone else coming to question them for a minute before the special forces arrive?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're forgetting that, Scott, that actually, you know, the Bush administration decided that it was a few bad apples. I'm joking.
That's right.
We know that
so it's all fine. Well, now, and here's the other thing is, and we got a break coming up here, but I think we got time for this, is about Obama's, his mandate in the Constitution to enforce all the laws and his mandate under the anti-torture statute that there's no discretion here. In fact, discretion is deliberately excluded from the possibility of things to be considered. There is no discretion. If anybody tortures anybody, you have to prosecute them, it says. And that's an American law that America forced on the whole world anyway, which is good, but, I mean, that's where it came from.
Yeah. Well, what we find out, Scott, is that in the end there is a little clique, and the clique is called the United States government, and some of those people are Republicans and some of those are Democrats. But it turns out that when the chips are down and when difficult decisions have to be taken, those difficult decisions won't be taken. You know, now we can all discuss who put pressure on whom, where and when and at what point to make sure that this wasn't going to happen. You know, it wasn't immediately obvious you know, in 2009 when Obama became president, that all the doors to accountability were going to become shut. But it happened pretty swiftly. And, you know, and that's what happens. You know, presidents don't go after the crimes of previous presidents. You know, this is a very small and select club of people who, you know, who don't actually prosecute each other for whatever it is that they do.
Right.
But, you know, the knock-on effect of that has been horrible because, you know, I think the acceptance of torture is a poison. It functions essentially like a poison in the bloodstream of a country. And I think that the acceptance of torture has poisoned America's soul. I think that, you know, that there's no exaggeration to say that. You know, everywhere that you look, there are right wingers, maybe people of other beliefs who, you know, but who are, you know, ferociously endorsing the right to torture people, the need to torture people, the obligation to torture people. You know, it's infected America, and, you know, until that's cut out, until it's addressed, It's a huge, huge problem.
Yeah, and you know, the CIA and America's sock puppet dictators around the world have always tortured people, but still, it's the abandonment even of the pretense now. And,
yeah.
You know, I remember when Abu Ghraib first broke on conservative Republican Texas talk radio, in fact, San Antonio talk radio, one of the most militarized towns in America, and the unanimous conservative consensus was, whoa, America doesn't go around torturing its captives. What in the hell is this? That's the kind of things that countries we attack do. In fact, that was one of the excuses for attacking Iraq. Saddam's a torturer. What in the hell is this? And they were really upset about it, but you know what? After a few years of arguing, turns out it's actually pretty debatable. And now, after a few years of that, we've lived in a country where torture's perfectly debatable. And I don't really believe in souls and collectives, really, but you're right that this society has become sick in a way because of that. But anyway, more with Annie Worthington right after this, y'all. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to talk to you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. In the book, Swanson explains what the revolution was, the rise of empire, and the permanent military economy, and all from a free market libertarian perspective. Jacob Hornberger, founder and president of the Future Freedom Foundation, says the book is absolutely awesome, and that Swanson's perspectives on the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis are among the best I've read. The poll numbers say that people agree on one thing, it's that America is on the wrong track. In The War State, Swanson gets to the bottom of what's ailing our society. Empire. The permanent national security bureaucracy that runs it, and the mountain of debt that has enabled our descent down this dark road. The War State could well be the book that finally brings this reality to the level of mainstream consensus. America can be saved from its government and its arms dealers. First, get the facts. Get The War State by Michael Swanson, available at your local bookseller and at Amazon.com. Or just click on the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Today's show is brought to you in part by Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook download at audibletrial.com/Scott. Audible has over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. For Scott Horton Show listeners, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with their free 30-day trial. I personally recommend Dirty Wars by Jeremy Scahill. It's great for anyone wanting the inside story on the cruel and counterproductive terror war of the Obama years. You can sign up for a free 30-day trial and download Dirty Wars at no charge by going to audibletrial.com/Scott. That's audibletrial.com/Scott.
And that common article 3 says that, you know, there will be no outrages upon human dignity. It's very vague.
Yeah, indeed it is. We're talking with Andy Worthington, andyworthington.co.uk. He's the author of The Guantanamo Files. He's the world's greatest chronicler of the crime of the Guantanamo gulag down there in communist Cuba. The American side of the wall, but same difference, basically. And you also wrote up this thing, Andy, very recently here about Omar Khadr. And I was hoping you could tell that story about this young man who...
Well, you know, this is Omar Khadr's, latest attempt to get the United States and Canada, his home country, to accept that, he has been treated in the most appalling manner since he was shot in the back in a firefight in Afghanistan as a 15-year-old, where he'd been taken by his father in July 2002. You know, and the story of Omar Khadr really is, it's as bad as it gets in terms of the breaking of laws and the making a child the repository of all your kind of vengeance and racism on the part of both the United States and Canada, because this is a kid who was in a compound that was raided by U.S. Special Forces one day in July 2002. Now they say that he threw a grenade that killed a U.S. Special Forces soldier. The story seems to be that accounts were fabricated afterwards that Omar was actually shot in the back and was unconscious under a pile of rubble when he was supposed to have been throwing the grenade. But even if he had thrown the grenade, this is wartime, and this is the kind of stuff that happens. But, you know, he's then,
Well, and he was, 14 or 15 at the time?
He's 15. So, you know, there's an optional protocol to the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child in Armed Conflict, which both the United States and Canada have signed. And that obliges the countries that have signed it to rehabilitate and not punish juvenile prisoners. So those are people who are under 18 at the age that their alleged crimes take place. Well, you know, neither America nor Canada did that. And, you know, and what happened was that, you know, Omar was then, you know, abused, taken to Guantanamo, held there, horrible things happened to him at Guantanamo for years, and eventually...
Well, but wait a minute, Andy. I mean, this kid must have been a real terrorist child prodigy to be in Afghanistan at the age of 15, right?
He was taken there by his dad, Scott, you know? When you're a child and not responsible for your actions, it's your parents, are the people who make the decisions about your life. It's not you making the decisions. But, you know, the worst part of the story to me, Scott, is that eventually, you know, America tried to put this guy on trial in one of their military commissions as though he was one of the worst of the worst. And eventually they said to him, look, you're not going to go home unless you agree to a plea deal. So in his plea deal, he had to admit that over and over again that he was responsible for his own actions. He then had to admit that he threw the grenade, even though it seems pretty certain that he didn't. And by doing that, he had to admit that he was a war criminal for having allegedly thrown a grenade that killed a U.S. Special Forces soldier in wartime. So, you know, this is the great shame, is that President Obama presided over a plea deal in which a former child prisoner said that it's okay what the Americans do in wartime, but if you fight against them, that's not war, that's a war crime. War crimes are traditionally atrocities involving civilians. War crimes have never, ever been engaging in combat in wartime in an occupied country. But that's what America did with Omar Khadr. Not only did they do that to this guy, but they did this to somebody who was a child when captured. You know, I mean, how can it get worse than that, really?
Well, let's go back to the grenade for a second. Why is it that you're so skeptical he threw the grenade?
Oh, there are reports, you know, reports that were written about it were altered afterwards. And that emerged in the and protracted pretrial hearings.
That's all the reasonable doubt you need right there, Your Honor. Case dismissed.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Didn't they say, Andy, that, oh, yeah, and he, like, pulled the pin with his teeth and he threw it back over his head like some TV show over the wall?
Yeah,
well, this thing was obviously made up by whoever made it up, even if it wasn't Cotter who made it up with a gun to his head.
Right. No, I mean, it's such a horrible story. But, you know, he's now trying to get his conviction thrown out in the U.S. And he's also trying to get the Canadians to treat him, you know, like a human being. Mm-hmm. Because his plea deal in 2010 involved an 8-year sentence, 1 year to be served in Guantanamo and the other 7 in Canada. Now, Canada dragged their heels for nearly a year. So he was in Guantanamo for nearly 2 years until he went home. And he's still banged up in a maximum security prison in Canada. And the Canadian government, you know, constantly portrays him as, you know, as this monstrous, violent jihadist and confessed murderer, ignoring the fact that, you know, it wasn't a fair trial that he had. And that they themselves, you know, violated all their obligations towards him because the Supreme Court of Canada decided that a few years ago, that Canadian agents had been to interrogate Omar Khadr at Guantanamo when he was just 16. And the Supreme Court ruled that they had violated his rights. But the Canadian government doesn't care because the Canadian government is only concerned with being as racist and xenophobic and Islamophobic as possible. And telling that repeatedly to the Canadian people, which is pretty horrible.
Now, I'm sorry, in your movie, do you focus on Cotter at all?
No,
okay,
we don't.
Because I wanted to recommend to people that documentary. Do you happen to know the name of the documentary offhand about Cotter? Because it's so powerful.
You don't like the truth.
Yeah, exactly. You don't like the truth. That's him protesting to his interrogator. Come on, man. I tried that. The truth. I gave up trying to tell you the truth a long time ago. You got to take a look at that, everybody. It's insane.
Yeah, no, it's a very powerful film, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really something else. Well, and now, I'm sorry, because we have only like 20 seconds, but can you tell us some of the tortures that this young man endured?
Omar Khadr?
Yeah.
Well, you know, they gave him the whole thing where they, you know, where they isolated him, they put him in painful positions, they subjected him to nudity, to loud noise. There's one point at which I think they sprayed pine disinfectant in the room that he was in.
Threatened his family too, right?
So that he then urinated, and then they used him as a mop to clean it up.
Oh, God.
They used him himself as a mop.
Oh, my God. And they threatened his parents, didn't they? Or threatened his mother
dad,
or something?
His dad died. But
we got to go, Andy. I'm sorry. AndyWorthington.co.uk, everybody. Appreciate it, man.
Always good to talk to you, Scott.
Fact. The new NSA data center in Utah requires 1.7 million gallons of water every single day to operate. Billions of Fourth Amendment violations need massive computers and the water to cool them. That water is being supplied by the state of Utah. Fact. There's absolutely nothing in the Constitution which requires your state to help the feds violate your rights. Our message to Utah? Turn it off. No water equals no NSA data center. Visit offnow.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. I've got the Harry Brown one on the bookshelf now. Makes me smile every time it catches my eye. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at myheroesthink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah, I never did hear back from the ACLU, which is too bad because, man, they got all this life in prison stuff I wanted to talk with them about. I know people get mad at the ACLU for taking weird positions on some things, but man, when it really comes down to people being held prison without trial and locked in solitary confinement for selling a little bit of crank to somebody or something, man, they're on it. They're saving the weak from the strong, man, is what they're doing. And I disagree with them about a lot of things sometimes, but comes down to it, America without them would be a totalitarian police state and would have had been for a hell of a long time ago. Huh? Would have been for a long time back since... What? Anyway. So, man, they're swearing in the new Fed lady. They're going to have... Yellen is her name. She's going to be the new chairman of the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee, which means the dictator of the currency. The commissar of American credit. And, yeah, it's going to be bad. Because, see, put aside the Austrians for a minute. They're just the ones who know better, but they don't have a say in this, okay? The only debate in public policy about what the government should do with the money is between the Chicago School right-winger, Republican, monetarist, supply-siders. You know all those terms. Those are all the same damn thing. What Reaganites think, okay? And then on the other side is the Democrats. I can hardly say it without crying. Listen, so what the Reaganites believe is you got to keep printing money, man. Don't stop printing money. Keep printing money. More. More. Don't ever stop. And what the liberals think is it's not enough. You got to print more money. You haven't printed enough money yet. Oh, and also you gotta spend more, too. Yeah, the less you have, the more you gotta spend, they say. And then there's the people who go, huh? And the Austrians who go, oh, no, no. That's the world of economics in America right there. And here's the problem. Actually, here's the brilliance of Ben Bernanke, the outgoing chairman of the Fed. While this lunatic dumps the nitrous oxide into the money printing machine and creates just trillions and trillions of dollars, expanding the monetary base, basically just to park the money in the vaults of the banks that needed bailing out. He figured out, dude, I can just have them write on their balance sheet, cool, I have this money now, and then put it back in the Fed. And all he's got to do, he gets to create more and more credit all day anyway, more and more money all day anyway. So it's fine. He'll pay them 1% above the market rate to just keep the money in Federal Reserve vaults. So that way, we do have price inflation, even during a downturn. But that's just because of what a bad downturn it is. That there's so many bad bets and so much deflation going on. It's keeping price inflation relatively low. And I know that you're saying, yeah, right, I just got back from the grocery store. And I'm just telling you, it could be way, way worse than that. It could be way worse than that. And I'm not the greatest Austrian monetary scientist or whatever, but there's some pretty obvious parallels here. Where during the 1920s, Rothbard explains this in America's Great Depression. During most of the 20s, remember they just had the big bubble and then crash from all the inflation to pay for the First World War. And so then they had the Depression of 1920-21, but they took a pretty hands-off approach. Bad debts were liquidated. People got back to work. There just happened to be a hell of a lot of new inventions coming out at the time and a lot of economic growth. You know, real economic growth in a lot of ways across the country. And they kept printing money, but prices didn't rise that fast. Well, in reality, what had happened was there was natural reasons why, not because of deflation, the crisis of 2021 was over, but because of a massive increase in productivity, you had a natural falling in prices. But because the Federal Reserve continued to create more and more money, that natural falling of prices, it wasn't necessarily halted, but it was diminished. Oh, it can't have a bunch of prices falling anyway. So then the real big bubble from 27 to 29 is the one that popped and led to the Great Depression. But in fact, the entire 20s had been this massive distortion in the economy. Even as all this great new productivity was taking place and new wealth was being created, it was all being distorted by the amount of credit that the government had created. And so I think that's what's going on right now, where there's a lot of price inflation going on, but it's disguised by the fact that we still have a lot of falling prices. And that's somewhat because of increased productivity, but it's mostly in technology, but it's mostly because of how many bad bets are still being canceled, how many bad loans, how much you know, writing off of bad investments from the last bubble as the government continues bailing out and bailing out and bailing out. But now here's the problem, is that if the economy, if you ever have most of those bad debts liquidated and you have, if they achieve what they claim to be pushing for, which is a healthy economy, a low unemployment rate increase in productivity, and it starts becoming an attractive thing for banks to make loans to small businessmen, then they're going to start doing that. I mean, the Federal Reserve could just continue, I guess, to raise the rate at which they pay the banks to not loan out the money they have, but they claim that's what they're trying to do, is get the economy back to health enough where a bunch of small businessmen are going to start taking out a bunch of loans and start putting people to work. But once that starts happening, then you have the fractional reserve ratio kick in. And where they've created trillions of dollars, you'll have trillions of dollars even more being loaned out into the economy, which would be a massive risk of widespread price inflation. We have bubbles in some parts of the economy now, and I'm not exactly certain which all, somewhat in housing in some places anyway, clearly in the stock market, they say in the bond market, although I don't understand all that stuff really good enough. But I do know that they've put the entire country into this horrible rock and a hard place, where if they succeed in making the economy hum, then they risk horrible, at least 1970s style inflation. And then the only way to beat that is to crank interest rates way, way up and force the recession and all the bankruptcies that they've been inflating to try to prevent all this time. Like what happened in the early 1980s when Jimmy Carter brought Paul Volcker in. Reagan couldn't get rid of him for a little while. But Carter actually was the one who brought in Paul Volcker, who raised interest rates up through the roof to finally just, oh, we're going to beat inflation, all right. We're going to strangle America. We're going to make anything that even is something rhymes with a marginal business, they're going out of business. Only the very strongest are going to survive the total headlock. That's it. All bad loans will be, written off, whatever, and we'll start over. And that was then. And here's the problem with that, is they can't raise the rates up like that because now the national debt is $17 trillion. Reagan, when he came into power, Jimmy Carter left him with like $1 trillion or something. He left with about $4 trillion. Now the national debt, Bush left it at, what, 14 or something? And Obama's brought it up to, and I forget exactly what it was when Clinton left, about 10. Bush brought up to about 14, something like that. And now Obama's got us in a $17 trillion national debt. So if they raise up the interest rate significantly to prevent that price inflation, well, then that makes it impossible to pay the interest payments on the debt to the bondholders, the foreign governments and the private investors around. So you see how we are completely screwed. All they can do is keep doing the wrong thing. And when the next bust comes, they'll have no other choice except to keep doing what they think is the only thing that they can do. And that is keep printing money. And so invest wisely. Hang on very tight to what little you got. Because if you thought Ben Bernanke was bad, if you thought he was reluctant to taper off the continuing QE price monetary inflation, then just wait till the liberals get here. Here she comes. This young lady is. And in fact, I missed the clip, but I could swear that the CNN guy who asked the other CNN guy the question that she had said, the stock market's been doing really good since my swearing-in ceremony started. Like somebody had texted her that or something? Or maybe since her name was announced, that the stock market really likes the idea of me being the new Fed chairman. Yeah, but what does that mean other than she's going to keep printing money and handing it to them? It's not that they would make money because the value of the companies continues to rise because of the awesome productivity and hiring and all that they're doing in real economic growth. She's just handing them wads of cash, and at your expense. And here's the thing too, is they will sell you, if you go to junior college, I guarantee they'll tell you inflation is good for the little guy because you get to borrow in dollars and pay back in dimes. Yeah, but what if you don't want to be a debt slave your whole life? What if you would rather save money and invest in yourself? It might as well be a felony. And this counts especially for poor people who don't trust banks wisely. Because, wow, boy, they just nickel and dimed me out everything I got. You pay me no interest whatsoever on money I leave in your account. And then, holy crap, all the fines and fees and transfers between one account and the other I didn't know I had to do. And screw you guys. I'd rather go and get screwed right in the face where I can see it at the money box on the corner where I know they're charging me an arm and a leg to cash my check. But at least I know how bad I'm getting screwed up front. They don't even want to deal with a bank in the first place. But then, if they want to deal with a bank, they can't make any money. You cannot, if you're a poor person and you want to save up and improve your own life, all you can do is put your money in some kind of gamble. Well, apparently there's a stock market bubble. Maybe I can buy a house and flip it before the price crashes on me. Maybe I can guess. What the hell do I know? Maybe I can guess which company's stocks are going to do well. And I'll have to try to become some kind of stock guru, says every dumbass who's barely got anything and doesn't know the first thing about the stock market. Because it's basically a felony for him to try to put his money in a plain old savings account. Because the rate of price inflation, real price inflation, where it counts at your actual prices for your cost of living, versus what they'll pay you to keep your money in there, it's a ripoff. And so it's really, the entire central banking system is actually a conspiracy against capitalism itself. I mean, what the hell is capitalism when there's no real capital? When all the where you don't even have access to any quote-unquote capital unless it's money currency, credit, created out of thin air by a bank with a government license to create new credit out of thin air. And make it impossible for you to save up and improve your own damn life without having to go to the Chase and say, oh yeah, can I please get some pretend capital from you? The whole thing is retarded. And, of course, it causes the great deformation because price signals are screwed out of whack all over the place. And so people, even really sharp businessmen, don't know how to make the right bet. Because they can't tell whether this is a good time to invest in more capital stock, a good time to hire more labor, a good time to save up for a rainy day, or start getting some layoffs in anticipation of the new thing coming, or they don't even know. Because the government is constantly screwing around with the price of money. Like Ron Paul says, half of every transaction, and you can't count on it. And so, not only is the economy distorted, but worse than you know. And you won't really know until the real crisis hits and the jerk on TV with the big red button starts screaming again that, oh my God, we need bailout money again for some reason. Somehow we made a bunch of bad bets based on erroneous information from the interest rate signals coming in, huh? And then they'll just do it again and again until America falls, which actually at this point is probably the best thing for the world, you gotta admit. And as far as I'm concerned, I think probably the only alternative is that eventually other major powers are going to gang up on us and make us quit all the ripping off everyone. Because, you know, for all the right-wing fears of a one-world currency and all that, the U.S. dollar is the one-world currency. That's why, by the way, everyone else on Earth hates it. That's why they ought to be skeptical of replacing it with another one. Because if you can have a currency, what are you going to do? You're going to print more of it all day. That's what I do. Wow, you mean you can make loans to your friends that have money that you never even had in the first place, and then you just take the kickback in the form of money? Great. What a great scam. I wish I owned a Congress. I'd have a Federal Reserve, too. But anyway, so, and as you can tell, I'm not a Ludwig von Mises fellow. I've got a layman's understanding of this, but I sure know better than every word out of these kooks' mouth on TV. And when they get it right, sometimes, in fact, British talking guy on CNN earlier, he was making a little bit of sense, but he didn't understand what it really meant in context, you could tell. Well, you know, they just keep printing money, but what does it mean? Oh. Anyway. Yellen. I hope I did a good job of explaining at least why it is, I think. Never mind whether it's a fact or not. You'll have to figure that out. We'll all have to see. But I hope I did a good job at least of explaining my thinking and why it is that they got us in such a rock hard place thing. Well, they have to inflate to prevent a recession, and they'll have to force a recession to prevent too much inflation. But if they do that, then they'll cause a bankruptcy of the whole damn country. And so what else can they do? I guess at some point they'll just have to write it all off. Anyway, smarter people than me know about this stuff. You should go and read them. They're called libertarians. All right. And now on Iraq. And listen, man, I know you heard Iraq too many times in your life and you never thought you would. Who would have guessed that after the Soviet Union disappeared that America would just pick Iraq to pick on for an entire generation in a row and kill millions of them? Who would have thought that? Is that crazy? Iraq? That piece of crap little country? And I know you're sick and tired of hearing about Americans killing Iraqis and getting Iraqis killed. But it's still important, and so I gotta insist. I mean, you don't have to listen, but I gotta say. The Americans are doing everything they can to intervene with the British so-called Chilcot Inquiry, which is sure to be some shade of whitewash, if not a pure, shining, bright white one. But the Americans are blocking any publication of what was going on there in the cooperation of the American government and the British government working together on plotting the premeditated murder of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. We already know from the Downing Street memos, option B, running start, that Bush pitched to Blair. Maybe we'll just get an American U-2 deliberately shot down over Iraq. We'll paint it up in UN colors so we can cry, oh, boo-hoo, baby blue. Wah. And then we'll just go ahead and start the bombing. And then we'll bring in the armor, you know, when we can get around to it. When we got Kuwait, you know, built up, our forces in Kuwait built up enough. They didn't do it that way, but that's the kind of thing that Bush and Blair were talking about at the ranch. Oh, yeah, and the Israelis were there that day, too. I wonder if that was Bush's idea after all. Think Ariel Sharon was there that day at the ranch, huh? All right. And there are massive suicide attacks across Iraq because the civil war continues to rage on. As you all know, there had never been a suicide bombing in the entire history of Mesopotamia, ever. Until America invaded in 2003. Until America decided to stay. Back in 1998. but once they stayed, that was it, man. That's where Al-Qaeda in Iraq came from. You know, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the worst suicide bomber Al-Qaeda leader in the history of the Iraq war and the worst fringe of the Sunni-based insurgency against the American occupation and American and Iranian-backed Shiite government there that we installed in Baghdad. He didn't even declare his loyalty to Al-Qaeda for 2 years. But at the end of 2004, he said, okay, I guess as long as bin Laden's goal is what I'm doing, I might as well, you know, join his PR front. That was where Al-Qaeda in Iraq came from. The permanent occupation, the attempted permanent occupation of Iraq by America. And now, you know, it's far from here, and I know everybody's tired about hearing about Iraq. I am too, man. Especially now that it's just, there's CIA and State Department and some mercs, but the American occupation is over. I don't want to cover it any more than you want me to, you know? I'm so sick of it. I can't stand it. But you know what? The thing of it is that when people get blown up, man, that hurts real bad. So it seems like since it's all the American politicians and the American civilians who supported them and their goals and the American military members who carried out their goals in Iraq, since it's all their fault, the American people, you know, those of us who care, including those who've changed heart about this, I think we kind of owe it to truth in general, to history, to the people of Iraq who survived that massive massacre in their country, to at least be honest about the aftermath of what the Bush invasion has wrought there and will continue. The dominoes are falling already all over the Middle East, and they will for probably the rest of our lifetimes because of what the Republicans did there. And, I mean, witness Libya, Syria right now, for example, those jihads going on. And it seems like, man, it's only fair that we at least talk about this, you know? In fact, that article that I read in the first, or that I talked about and read from in the first part of this, the Atlantic article about the young man, obviously 100% innocent of all charges, who was thrown in prison and then quickly in solitary confinement for a crime he didn't commit. That article, in fact, the article again is titled Half a Life in Solitary. You can find it on my Facebook page. It's at theatlantic.com. Half a Life in Solitary. How Colorado made a young man insane. And at the end of this, here's what he says. I have enough time, I think. I want to quote this exactly, because here's what the writer for The Atlantic says. He says, "A disgrace that represents a collective degree of culpability. It takes many people, including many people who believe they are well..." That's a deliberate sentence fragment for effect there. He's talking about this poor guy, Sam Mendez, and what happened to him. a disgrace that represents a collective degree of culpability. It takes many people, including many people who believe they are well-meaning, to generate a result like this. We are all responsible for what happened to this man. We enacted the laws and upheld the rules and supported the officials responsible for his dire state. None of it happened by accident. None of it was ordained by fate. We all did this to him, and now the question is whether we are going to do something about it. Now, as pure Bolshevik claptrap. And what the hell are you talking about, man? You know, I'll tell you who's responsible. People who love and support cops. People who vote for Republicans and Democrats and say things like, good, they're building a new prison, and support the war on drugs, and support their local police no matter what crime they commit. The politicians, the cops, the prosecutors, the judges, they're the ones who did it, the ones who did it, and the ones who cheer for it. But that doesn't include me. And how in the world could that include you or anybody else? It's amazing to me that anybody cheers for this corrupt system that we all know better than. You go, in 1 second you'll be cracking a joke about how all lawyers are the worst scum on the face of the entire planet, and then you'll turn right around and beg a government that is nothing but lawyers from top to bottom, front to back, and beg them to care for every part of your life and keep you safe from all the big baddies. I mean, maybe not you, but whoever. Person sitting next to you then. So maybe Andrew Cohen at The Atlantic feels like he is part of the collective responsibility because of how much he loves prison guards for keeping us all so safe all day. Oh, protecting our freedom. Where would we be without them? But that's not what I think. And I'm not responsible. I do feel a responsibility for trying to do something about it, but that's not because I did it. You are me, and I am you, and we the people, and these are just words. That's not right. And, you know, in the ACLU thing, they quote the judges talking about, son, this is the worst travesty in the history of my career. I can't believe I have to do this. Boom! Life in prison without parole for some meth in your pocket. What? It's just like Eugene Jarecki's movie about the drug war, where he interviews the judge. He gets a great interview with the judge talking about how unfair it is. And yet he doesn't mind going to work every day. What would you have to do to get a judge to resign over this and say, I will not continue to put nonviolent people in prison for life without parole, for possession? Son, this is the worst thing I've ever done to anyone in my life. Bangs the gavel. That's who's responsible. The responsible. And yes, civilians who cheerlead for this state, which has declared war on us all, if you hadn't noticed, are somewhat responsible too. And I feel the same way about Iraq. There was no shortage of people, and I had the job driving a cab at the time, so I was meeting strangers all day and night. And there are a lot of people who knew better, a lot of people who knew better. But boy, were there a lot of people who couldn't wait to participate in the vicarious slaughter of the Iraqis for having nothing to do with the attacks on America, other than the attacks were partially waged to avenge their victimhood. It's sickening. And yeah, there's a responsibility there for the war and for innocent people in prison, but it doesn't belong to me. You gotta ask you if it's yours.